Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is a look at the Tribeca Film Festival, plus whatever else we might have been watching. Very happy to be back on with Amy Taubin. Hello, Amy.
Hi, Nick. So we made it through Tribeca.
We did, yeah. The Tribeca, the festival that...
The festival is no longer a film festival. And it actually had, I don't know, as of 4 or 5 years ago, sold a controlling interest to James Murdoch, one of the Murdoch sons, who was not involved with the family TV business, but seems to be, I don't know how you say this, taking a controlling interest in festivals of all kinds, because he's done the same thing with Art Basel. And so I think he has four of them now. And as of last year, probably because of this, the Tribeca Film Festival became simply the Tribeca Festival. And it began to be very noticeable this year that although they still say that film is at the core of it, their interests are really elsewhere. I mean, their interests are really in virtual reality and immersive stuff, in being a kind of umbrella for different organizations, most of them very good, and most of them very involved with gender and race and politics.
I mean, immediately I flash to the Penske media guy who continues to gobble up publications.
Exactly. I now work for a Penske publication, Art Forum.
Yeah, there was something else that they just acquired, Penske.
Yeah, they did.
They have a, I don't know if it's controlling interest, but weren't they one of the parties involved in taking over the Golden Globes?
That's right.
So the Golden Globes is now part owned or part managed by the same holding company that runs the publications that's going to cover the Golden Globes.
Exactly.
So round and round it goes. But I did not know that about Tribeca. I didn't even know that a festival was necessarily a very profit-making endeavor.
I don't think it is. And it was notable that although they had a lot of sponsors, I don't think they were as many as, say, the New York Film Festival. So this is not up their profile in that way. But it is much, I don't know, kickier than it's been. I mean, it's full of people who come to see live talks and particularly music performances. And since we've started, I mean, one of the big, big draws was the very famous Japanese game maker,
right,
Hideo Kojima. There was a documentary about him, and he came, and he did an extended Q&A. And this fairly large space in Spring Studios, which is also where the David Fincher Steven Soderbergh dialogue was held, was totally sold out for Kojima long before the festival started, with no press tickets available. And then you could go to movies and there was no one there.
Yeah, I missed to see the Hideo Kojima doc. But what was curious to me is that I could find almost no review coverage of it. I mean, I don't know if that was sort of beside the point, really, but it was just kind of curious that obviously, he's the event. It didn't really matter entirely.
Exactly. And the way the documentary was, I mean, I just saw it online in the press where you could go to look at things online. There isn't even a director credited. So that's what I mean by when I say it's totally hagiographic. It's made by his company, clearly.
Right.
But he is there a lot. And everyone is saying, you know, he's a genius. But the process is really quite extraordinary. And, you know, the thing that's very good in terms of me still teaching young students who want to do nothing except play video games and make them is he says, well, you know, where my inspiration comes from is movies. I grew up on movies. So it's David Lynch and David Cronenberg and Stanley Kubrick, you know, that's in my blood, in my psyche.
Oh, that's great.
So that was really important. And then you look at it, it looks like a video. but supposedly his games are really different And he's become an independent. He formed his own company. So he doesn't have to answer to, well, Sony was somehow involved in this documentary. So when I say he doesn't have to answer to Sony, he kind of does. But.
Well, I mean, I can, I mean, if it's possible to become an independent as a game designer, I mean, that seems the way to go because they basically mint money off those games. I mean,
Yeah.
hasn't it been the case that when you add up like the profits from selling games that it's kind of routinely higher than movie box office, I guess.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean,
Yeah. Well, I am moved. I am inspired to buy myself a PlayStation 5 and see if this game is any different. Supposedly, it's not a Darwinian game. You know, it's the end of the world and you fight it out with your opposition and one person wins, which is what all video games are.
Right.
But this one really, people said it kept them from suicide during COVID. And it's basically about people who are totally alone in the world. What has happened that people are alone and isolated? I'm not sure. And they know there might be another person just like them in the world. And so it's a search to find another lonely person, another isolated person just like you.
Wow.
That's what this game is. And to come together with them, or at least as it's described in this movie, that's what it is.
Isn't that like the old platonic idea of, I don't know, people were split and then they brought together again or something like that?
Exactly.
Well, yeah, that does sound like that would be some kind of comfort. I mean, there were also movies, and I guess I have to say that this year I was paying a bit more attention than in past years. I did feel like there were more that I was just kind of intrigued by and watching. And there was, for you, I guess there was one definite standout, if you want to talk about that one.
Yeah, these two guys who are responsible for this movie, they contacted me before the festival. I mean, I get, once people find out you're covering Tribeca, you get lots of emails saying, do you want an advance link? And they're always from publicists. But this one came directly from the two guys who made this wonderful film. And their backstory is very, very, very interesting. It is a film that's really about the global South. The director, Edmundo, is Bolivian, and he, about 20 years ago, emigrated to Berlin, where he met Carlos Vargas, who had immigrated from Colombia to Berlin, and they met in a German language class. And they were both interested in making films. And Edmundo did make a film that was about 50 minutes long, and I have a link to it. It has no titles, but it's extremely interesting. And not unlike the film Melody of Love. And it won a prize, the FePressi Prize in the Buenos Aires Film Festival a couple of years ago. And then he, the director, went to, I don't know exactly why, to Ethiopia, to Addis Ababa, and fell in love with the city and fell in love with the jazz scene there, which is around a very great jazz musician, Mulatu Astatke, who is the father of Ethiopian jazz. And Jim Jarmusch has used a lot of his tracks in his films. He's really, really a great musician. And so the director of Melody of Love spent 6 months going to hear this guy play every week. And his practice is that he invites young musicians to play with him. It's essentially free jazz in this club and to come up and improvise with him. And so he met some of these musicians, one of them in particular, who was is also a kind of performance artist. I hate to say this, but one of the characters that he plays is Michael Jackson. And so Edmundo conceived a film around this music scene and around the city. And the story is very simple. It's this musician who was born in Ethiopia, but whose family with him had emigrated to Brussels. And then he goes back to Addis. and he falls in love with Otis, but his mother summons him home and says, you have to be responsible and come home and be with me and your sister. And so the film is set the last 3 days that he's going to be in Otis, and where he says goodbye to his friends and his girlfriends. And it's a very sexy movie. It has some of the best sex scenes I've ever seen. And like everything else in this movie, each of them is about 30 seconds long. Because almost nothing in the film. No single shot. And they all look like they're locked down. But I'm told by the filmmakers that the producer is also the cinematographer, Carlos Vargas, that he handheld everything, and he had some sort of fantastic stabilizer in the camera, but everything's handheld, but it looks like the camera is locked down. And the shots are very short, and each of them, almost all of them, are bisected so that in some way you see two spaces at once. Either you're on a terrace and you see then half the frame is a very deep space of the city, or you're in an apartment and the camera's in a hallway that can see into two different rooms. And that just seemed to me to be this incredible metaphor for this guy who is stuck between wanting to be in two places and unable to, you know, solidify where he is and how he's going to be able to exist. And the other thing is it has a fantastic soundtrack, of which the music is part. You know, it also, I mean, people who are looking for a music film about this great jazz musician, you're not going to find it because the music scenes, the live music scenes, none of them are more than 60 seconds long either. But the music seems to cue the images, and they combine with the sounds of the city and the rain and everything else. I mean, it's just a great track. I just love this film. I just fell in love with this film.
I caught it right at the end on your recommendation. I think it was the last thing I saw in the festival. And it's audiovisually just very sensuous or sensual.
Yeah.
And yeah, I noticed that the split as well going on in the compositions. And it's just also very like a heavily like romantic nocturne kind of vibe to it as well. Like, it's raining a lot. It's it probably rains as much as like a Cy Ming Liang film, you know. I did think of Cy a little bit.
When I interviewed him, he cited Cy as an inspiration.
Oh, no kidding. Okay.
Yeah,
just the way he sits with moods and the palette that he puts together also I felt was something to itself, just kind of purples and then just experimenting with particular shots and particular scenes. I mean, one of the love scenes is the screen is completely dark, but the main actor, he's holding a cigarette lighter that he like flicks open for a little bit at a time. And I don't know, it's just such a playful way of filming that. So the whole screen will be sort of partly lit for a while, and then he clicks it out and it's out again. And then when he does go back to his mom, he sings with his sister, and his sister has an amazing voice.
Yeah, his sister has a great voice. I mean, it's all together like an 85-minute film, and the last 25 minutes are in Brussels, and the palette is totally different. And this young man's sense of not wanting to be in Europe, I mean, feeling so alienated and, you know, that he is looked down on in Europe as much as Europeans are supposed to be nice. And it's just so painful, the European section.
Yeah, and it's good you said it's about the global South. Yeah, because it reverses, you know, what other movies like often are, that where it's like, oh, I have to go back home. Like, it could have been reversed. Like, he had to go back home to Addis Ababa to visit his family or something. But in this case,
yes, yeah.
Yeah, he's like, I want to stay here, you know, and he has his like two of his friends and they just want to hang out. And I love how kind of uncompromising the ending is in that regard. Like, I don't want to spoil the final sequence, but that was really one of the greater endings I've seen in a while. Did you say this is a debut feature?
Yeah, I mean, he made a 50-minute film a couple of years ago, but as a feature, this is his debut. And as far as I can tell, they had no money at all. It's flying like four flags, Argentina and Ethiopia and Germany and maybe Bolivia. But I don't know what they got from any of those countries. And then neither of them had ever been to New York before. And they didn't have a PR person and they didn't have a sales rep. As far as I can tell, they are repping it themselves. And they are hoping that somehow they'll get into some festivals.
Yeah, it's definitely not a movie that I was hearing about. So it just reminds you how, yeah, you can miss out.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I get compulsive and try to look at everything and then, but.
Yeah. So Melody of Love, which weirdly, I don't know if this happened to you, but when I was typing it in just to double check the director's name, it brought up like the name of a silent movie from the 20s that was also called Melody of Love. I wouldn't even know, yeah, what section that, I guess that's an international narrative.
It was Viewpoints, because they think of this as an experimental film.
Right.
In other words, it couldn't be in competition because I don't know why, but Viewpoints.
What is interesting, though, is that one of the prize winners, which I did watch that I actually like, A Strange Path, that one sort of had some experimental aspects to it, but kind of just very instrumentally used in a way.
That one won 4 prizes.
Yeah.
It won everything in international narrative.
Yeah, I don't know. I probably would have spread the wealth around, but I did like it.
I didn't not like it. It kind of made me really sick. I'm sorry. I mean, it is about sickness.
Yeah, yeah.
It's set in Brazil in some, I don't know where, some small city at the beginning of COVID. And I kind of knew what was going on, and we can't talk about it because the big reveal is at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a psychodrama. I mean, it really exists in the head of this central character. And I guess I just didn't want to be inside his head.
Well, it's a very frustrating place to be. I mean, he's like on the cusp of finally premiering a movie he's made. And then I had to wonder if this happened to the director, but he's flown into Brazil. I guess he lives in Portugal, but suddenly finds himself having to pay his own way because the festival obviously gets canceled. Something that absolutely does not surprise his girlfriend, which is kind of funny. She's like, yeah, of course, what are you doing? But yeah, it's a completely frustrating place to be in it. And he's trying to get in touch with his father, who's just estranged with. And I guess what I like was, yeah, I guess the psychodrama aspect of the kind of negotiating that relationship and the weirdness of his father was kind of interesting to me. And I mean, there's sort of like, there's a big reveal at the end, but there's also like, I don't know, about halfway or 2/3 away. I mean, you realize this father, who is always like too busy to talk, he's always like working on something, you realize you're told what he's working on, and I have to say that was like really funny that he turns out to be writing something you might not expect him to be writing. I guess what I meant to say is that I wouldn't have expected this movie to win all those prizes, because it's all about being caught in this in-between space. So it's in some ways a kind of static movie.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I don't know, it seemed to resonate with, I don't know, whoever was giving the prizes for that. But there's always like a couple of documentaries, I think, that are pretty interesting. And there was a Ukraine one that you liked a lot too.
Yeah, I like the Ukrainian documentary, Rule of Two Walls.
Yeah.
And the director, David Gutnick, I mean, he comes from a Ukrainian family. He lives in the U.S., he went back to make a film about the war, and he decided to focus on artists who remained in the country. And he found this woman who runs an art center in Kyiv that also is one of the big bomb shelters. So that's one kind of location or one kind of metaphor. What's interesting about the film is there's a lot of daily life. It begins with a couple in the morning and they kind of just finished making love and they get up and make breakfast and they go about their regular lives. And then suddenly the city is being bombed. And the film, it's really in terms of showing deaths, bodies that are burnt and dismembered by bombs. In close-up, it does not, you know, pull away in any way like that. And when you see this, you also realize that the camera people and the sound people are in grave danger. They put themselves in the middle of this, in the middle of fires and bombs exploding. So it's this combination of people going about their everyday lives and extreme passages of death. And at a certain point, the director interviews about five of the principals involved in the making of the film about what they feel like living their lives like this and making this film. And it was very interesting that the cinematographer says he feels nothing. He's absolutely incapable of feeling. I mean, I just thought that choice to do that was really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a really strong film.
I did too, and part of it is just the density of it. It manages to let a lot of artists, including makers of the movie, voice what they're thinking about, what's about their work, about their country, their family, without making it feel like a glancing kind of survey. It really gets you quickly into each artist's headspace. And yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, it's a cinematographer, and then, I mean, a couple of other people who work on the movie that you also, and they only reveal that at the end of the sequence of each sort of segment, that that's who's talking. So you suddenly have this, you're like, oh, the thing I'm watching, that's what the person's feeling. And yeah, for the cinematographer to be saying that, you understand it with some of the images that he's catching. And I like that too, that it does not shy. And I don't think necessarily that other Ukraine documentaries are avoiding showing these kind of things. I mean, that's one way of looking at it, but this one definitely does it. And the fact that it's about artists, you might think that it would, that it's going to show you how people have interpreted or, reformulated what they're watching, but that's the refrain. The bodies are the refrain.
Yeah.
It's weird to say I'm glad to have seen that, but what I keep coming back to with this war is just how it still managed to be pushed to the periphery. I mean, this happens with every single war. I don't, it's just
Absolutely.
that's always what's kept away. And no matter how much, every 10 years, every generation, we think, oh, we finally learned the lesson. We need to know what it actually looks like. It still doesn't get shown. It still isn't actually out there. So you never actually know what the consequences are. It all just feels like arid geopolitical maneuvers that are all spoken of in euphemisms. So yeah, I was impressed. And then, oh, the title. My understanding is that the rule of two walls is what you do when you don't have a bunker. Basically, it's kind of like if there's a hurricane or tornado or something that you kind of.
Yeah, you get between two walls.
Yeah. Which is a good, like, poetic title, but it's a little confusing, I found. But yeah, it makes sense. So that was The Rule of Two Walls. And then I think there was another documentary at Tribeca that you were able to see that I had heard about, but I didn't end up watching. I kind of wish I did. That's Transition.
Right.
That one, a lot is happening in that one.
Yeah, it's about an Australian filmmaker who for several years has been on assignment in Afghanistan and born a woman, but in Afghanistan, dressing as a man in this situation where gender is a very big issue. So not only is he in danger if anyone found out that they had breasts, but so would the partner who knows, the Afghani partner who they've been working with would be in equal danger. And so they decide to actually transition in Afghanistan, in Kabul, where there is one doctor who gives hormone treatments. And Jordan, one of the two filmmakers of this film, because it's co-made, begins that treatment, and almost immediately Afghanistan falls to the Taliban. And so the situation becomes much more dire because they are in a position of constantly having to go in the line for the men or the line for the women and to be searched and present credentials, et cetera, et cetera. And they decide that they have to have top surgery, but they can't get it in Afghanistan. And in the meantime, they have taken an assignment that puts them living in the country on a farm with a Taliban family. And the interesting thing about this is that this Taliban family is not what we think of as the Taliban leadership. They seem like an ordinary Afghanistan family. But it's very clear to the filmmaker and their partner that if this were found out, their lives would be in danger. And in addition, the filmmaker begins to feel incredibly guilty about lying, about, you know, deceiving the family that is their subject about their gender.
Mm-hmm.
And so this situation is extremely difficult. And eventually they leave with another person who's involved in the film, who is a very famous photographer of women who's Iranian. And she has contacts in Iran with someone who will do this top surgery, because in Iran, gender reassignment and surgery is possible. And so that's what happens. And briefly, the filmmaker goes back to set up the route for his partner to get out of Afghanistan, which is difficult. And it's a kind of happy ending at the end. They reunite somewhere. It might be Berlin. I think it's Berlin. But right now, they are in Bosnia, and they continue to work.
Wow. And I mean, in terms of what they're filming when they're in Afghanistan.
They are filming scenes for this documentary that's going to be on Australian TV.
Okay.
So you see them filming that, and you see them interviewing the family and all of that. And before that, you see them riding around in Kabul and trying to negotiate roadblocks and searches and all of that. So you actually are seeing them making the film that they are there to make, but you also see very personal private scenes. For example, you see Jordan when they are in the hospital after having top surgery. I think it's really, really strong. I do not know why it didn't get more attention in a festival where gender and trans were so highlighted.
Mm-hmm.
There was very little about this film. I mean, maybe people thought it was just too, I don't know what.
I would hope it comes out.
Me too. I think it does have some form of distribution.
Okay. That is Transition. And then one other movie I think you mentioned.
Cinnamon just took the grand prize in the, I think it's called the American Black Film Festival that was in Miami.
Ah, okay.
And it won Best Narrative Feature. It's a first feature, and the director is Brian Keith Montgomery Jr. And it has a great ensemble cast that is led by two women, a young actor named Haley Kilgore, and she is totally amazing. And she is the protagonist. And then Pam Grier has the force of total and utter evil. And then there are guys, and the guys are amazing. And some of them are kind of well known from movies and TV, but most of them are young and I've never seen them before. Mm-hmm. And they're just great. I mean, I guess they wanted to make a modern day blaxploitation film with all the tropes of a blaxploitation film. But what it turns out to be is a much more concise Quentin Tarantino film, because the structure of the narrative has all those loop-de-loops that Tarantino has, where what is the present moment of the film is in dispute, because you go for 20 minutes and then you've looped around into a pre-story and then you come back to the starting point and then you loop around past the starting point to where the starting point, the first scene ended. And so that loop-de-loop structure from different points of view is really executed wonderfully. I was really impressed with this film. It was the only thing I saw at Tribeca that I thought, hey, this is a really good commercial film.
And you mentioned that's a first feature, right?
First feature. And it wasn't in competition in Tribeca. It was in one of those weird categories.
Right.
Like
right.
Spotlight or
Viewpoint, Spot View, View, View Light.
Yeah, right.
And then I know you also went to an event or two, which I always mean to go to, but I don't. And I know that they have like a zillion of them. But this one especially, because it was a conversation between
yes.
Steven Soderbergh and David Fincher. How was that?
That was an extremely hot ticket.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've just been writing about how the new incarnation of Tribeca, where they've dropped film from the title of the festival, you know, The films themselves were in these really grotty multiplexes where it was so silly to have a red carpet at the AMC 19th Street. Really?
Wait, they really did that?
Yes, they did red carpets for a lot of films, and they were at AMC 19th Street in the Village East. It's just like, what? But the glamour of the festival is really in these special events, and a lot of them are in Spring Studios, which have gotten very spiffy, and it's where the virtual reality is held, which is now called Games and Immersive.
Okay.
And that's where they're putting their energy, I hate to say it, but it's true. So Fincher and Soderbergh, who are good friends, and as Soderbergh confessed, he probably talks to Fincher more often, twice a week, than people who are he's really supposed to be close to in his personal life. And they couldn't be more different as filmmakers or in terms of what they want as their career, except that they are, both of them, very, very smart and very clear about what they want to do. And so I was hoping it would go two ways and they would interview each other about different areas of their work. But actually, it was just Soderbergh interviewing Fincher.
Was there a particular occasion? Because I know Fincher is in some stage of a movie currently.
Seems to be getting ready to finish a film that's coming out in this calendar year. But not much was said about that.
Right.
So basically, they went through Fincher's career from what Fincher still thinks is the disaster of Alien 3 and why everything didn't just end there. It's a mystery for him, I think. You know, and I know that Alien 3 is not the movie he would have made if he had made it from scratch, but I love Alien 3. So.
Yeah, I never thought it was that bad. But it's also funny that in a way, I guess both of them had kind of career hiccups around the same kind. I'm not on the same scale, but didn't, I mean, Soderbergh, wasn't that around when he did Kafka and I got which or something?
Yeah, I think that was the timing. But the thing was that Soderbergh's first film, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, was an enormous success. And Alien 3 was actually Fincher's first feature. And it was the kind of first feature that they tell you you'll never recover from. But for him, it was just, I will never be in business with people who do not understand what I am doing.
Right.
That was it.
But he recovered, and then some.
Yeah. But he's very, you know, open about his work and how certain films worked out and certain films didn't. And he talked quite a bit about Seven, because Seven is about to be, he's remastering it now in 4K. So he's being forced to look at it because he says he doesn't ever look back at his films, but this time. And that was pretty funny because talking about remastering 4K, he basically said, well, you know, there were scenes where the windows are blown out. And when you're looking at windows blown out on the screen projected, they look kind of like, you know, like there's a lot of light out there,
right,
ambient
right.
light. But when you look at it on just on 4K, it looks like you didn't have any money and you put white guards outside the windows. So he's talking about recreating tiny bits digitally of, you know, about 3% of an image out of those windows.
Oh, my God.
So that's the kind of detail, I mean, obsessive detail. And, you know, the films that are good, he sees the forest for the trees and the films that are bad. I mean, this is me talking. He doesn't see, like Mank, he didn't see the forest for the trees. But, you know, he's a great filmmaker. And the difference between him and Soderbergh is that he says, so I send Steven a cut. And within 2 days, he sends it back to me with 40 minutes cut out.
Yeah, I can never get over it. Yeah, Soderbergh seems to have like a computer in his brain when it comes to like editing and structure and that sort of thing.
And the other thing is that he edits his own films. He shoots his own films, where Fincher talked a lot about how he works with what is more or less a regular team and how the work with the cinematographer and the editor, and coming to understand that you are the leader. But if everyone understands the project in the same way, then they bring their expertise to the project in a way that's beneficial. And I thought that was very, although no one in that audience is ever going to be able to command the kind of capital that Fincher commands for his film. And that probably includes, at this point, Steven Soderbergh, unless he wants to make another Oceans movie. But he was very clear about how he uses those kinds of resources. He was also very clear about the agony it is for him to make a film. I mean, anyone who ever thought sitting there, oh, well, it's so hot and exciting and you're a film director. This is a guy who's in misery all the time and he doesn't hide it. I mean, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it seems especially exacting. I mean, just interesting the effect that that has with his movies, that they end up having like this heightened reality to them. You absorb just the minute detail to it.
Yeah. And these storyboards, you know, for films that then don't get made. I mean, that was the kind of tragic moment when Soderbergh talked about seeing, you know, these maps and graphs and charts of everything in some film that in the end, the funding just gets pulled.
What was an example of that?
He didn't, they were not specific. I mean, I don't know if they ever made maps and graphs for The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo to be a trilogy, but it was intended to be a trilogy.
Oh, right. Uh-huh.
So.
Did we ever talk about Mank? I can't remember whether we did.
I don't know. You know, Finch is a great filmmaker, but I just thought it was so dead. And part of it was that Gary Oldman, who's a great, great actor and who's a good friend of Fincher's, just was so wrong for that part. You know, and somehow never wrapped his head around that character. I think probably because, you know, to the end they were ambivalent about Mankiewicz. I don't think they sorted out, you know, the Wells Mankiewicz story or the emotional part of that, where the filmmaking energy came from. And everyone wanted to tell that story differently. I mean, it was interesting when Fincher talked about Zodiac, and there was a question, they let the audience ask questions, none of which were very good. But someone asked about why some other interpretations of who the Zodiac might have been didn't come into the film, why they stuck with that one interpretation. And Fincher said, well, that was the book we bought. We didn't buy all the other books. We bought that one book. And I thought that was really interesting. You know, it wasn't that he was going for, let's have the widest documentary truth brought in here. There was a narrative.
Right.
Someone believed this story. He was a character in the film, too. And we bought that story.
That's also pretty honest about how, like, Hollywood properties work, I guess, to a certain extent.
Yeah, but I actually think Zodiac and Social Network are his great films.
Yeah, The Social Network is kind of endless rewatch. It's like a song, you know, it just sort of, it just moves like that. Zodiac, I definitely was a person who, the first time I saw it, I didn't get what it was doing. And then the second time I did.
Well, I was that way too.
Oh, really?
I remember Gavin sent me to see it and I came out of it and I said, I don't know, maybe it looks like shit. Why don't I like it? And then I went back and thought it was the greatest film I'd ever seen. But I also talked to Harris Savides.
Oh, wow.
About it. Because Harris was a student of mine. The first year I ever talked, Harris was a senior at SVA. And he just came and sat in on my classes. And so we stayed friends. And Harris, they were making a film set in the 70s. And Fincher wanted it to look like the 70s, but he also wanted it shot digitally, which was given, the technology at that point, really hard to do, to recreate a 70s film look digitally. And Harris kept saying, it's like he's given me, the film is the plane, but he's put it on the wrong runway and he expects me to take off and I can't.
Yeah, that's a tall order, definitely. I mean, even with just finding the right palette, I ended up liking how it looks. That's amazing. Okay, so that was the Soderbergh and Fincher.
So you should talk about some films you saw.
One of them I saw, that's Q, which is a documentary directed by Jude Chahab. And it's a very personal documentary, and I think she did all the camera work in it. It's basically about her mother, who was part of a religious sect that just seemed to be all-consuming. So her mom just spent a ton of time, but at a certain point decided she needed to kind of separate from it. So the movie is basically her just talking with her mother over this period of kind of extracting and separating herself over a couple of years. And somehow out of that, and also using home movies, and it just becomes this really, it's almost like a story about like a breakup in a way, except like it's a, I mean, just in terms of the intensity of the emotions and kind of vacillating also that goes on. But there's a community aspect too, that she's going to be cutting herself off from all these people that she knew. She has an especially tense, her mother has an especially intense relationship with the leader. One thing that the movie does is doesn't actually reveal the name. And apparently that was like the one condition of making the movie was that her mother wanted to make sure that this person was not identified by name. I don't really know exactly the significance of that. But yeah, she's very attached to her. And like when you hear her poetry about the sect, I mean, it's in the manner of like some religious poetry. It also sounds almost like romantic poetry. It has that intensity.
Wow.
So somehow it manages to be like not completely claustrophobic also because it was shot partly, during lockdown in pandemic. That's partly she's just sort of living with her parents. And I was impressed by also just on a filmmaking level because I felt like she was really good, Chehab, at just framing her mother, talking to her, and finding new ways of framing. And even like someone suddenly visits and she does this kind of neat thing of just finding this rhythm of panning between them. That's kind of, you're kind of like, oh, this is kind of interesting. I'm definitely looking forward to what she does next.
And where was it made?
Her family is from Lebanon. I mean, the director is based, I believe, in New York, but what happened is she, I guess, she visited them and then was bit more or less stuck with them. So, as she said to me, she that made it easier to kind of put her mother on the spot because they couldn't escape. So, but they also go outside of the home. Her mother is a professor. She also, runs like a poetry organization. So they have meetings like that as well. So I hadn't really seen anything like this that was from the inside in this way. Like, there are a lot of movies where you're kind of interviewing people who have left some religious situation or something like that, or you're doing a kind of like autopsy almost, on what happened or something. So that was interesting. And then another movie, which I'll just mention quickly, is called Mountains. That's a fiction feature. And this is set in Miami. It's set in a Haitian American community in Miami. And what I loved about this movie was basically really one thing, especially, and it centers on these parents and just the warmth in their relationship is pretty extraordinary. I don't, it's one of the things where you watch it and it just feels so natural and effortless between them. And they're just kind of doting on each other. And the dad is a construction worker, their son is a stand-up comic.
Oh my God.
So there's like obvious generational divide there, and he's living with them because he can't yet afford to live on his own. And they handle that pretty well. And they also go deep into his world. He's in a completely different place than his parents are. His parents are trying to maybe find like another house to just settle down in. The irony being that he kind of, as a construction worker, is like knocking down houses that later get sold, like resold, and he's trying to find his own house. But yeah, I just really like the warmth between the two of them. And yeah, I don't know. It seems like a simple thing, but it's something that portraits of family don't actually always pull off. You don't actually believe that there's like a closeness, the way that there is here. So there's that. And then one more film, which is just kind of like, I don't know, catnip a little bit, just like the Patricia Field documentary, which kind of had like not my favorite title. It's called Happy Clothes. And I can understand anyone who like didn't want to see it based on the title, because that doesn't really tell you anything. It's only if you watch the movie you realize, because it's all about her designing and partly about her history, you know, in the city, but also just it shows her actually, I forget if she's working on like Emily in Paris or like the next Sex and the City reboot or whatever. But they show her actually like going through different clothing with it with an actor. But I like how they kind of just show you her actual process in a way that's not this sassy thing where like it's just like very practical. It's like, does this work? Does this work? I thought this might work. And that's where the title comes in, like, because people are always like, well, how did you figure to put this together with that? And she said, I, you know, I just liked it. She just says, happy clothes. You know, that's what I like. So you're not going to get anything. She's just too busy just coming up with the things. But the main strength of the movie is that they realize when you have a subject like her, you don't need a lot of talking heads. They do have all the famous people you might expect, like Sarah Jessica Parker, etc. But you can just put her on screen and just be driving. There's a whole sequence where she's dictating the directions off of the FDR. That's great.
Well, I'm glad she's really still working.
Yeah.
I was unaware of that because I think there's another, I could be wrong about this. There's another designer on the new incarnation of Sex and the City.
There is, they go a bit into that, the kind of nuances of, am I the head costume designer or am I just a consultant? This consultant is kind of better because then I just have less to worry about. I can just like pick things and then leave. So yeah, it was fun. And she's kind of, I see her in the neighborhood a lot. Once I just saw her in like the supermarket, just pushing her cart. So nice. I'm sure that's going to be showing at some point. It seems an impossibility that it won't be, but I'm not actually sure it does have a distributor yet. Happy Clothes. I don't know. And The League.
The League is opening in July. I like it a lot.
And I also saw Eric LaRue. My previous episode is an interview with Michael Shannon. But I guess we can sort of wrap up on the Tribeca portion. I don't know if you have any last things to say about Tribeca. I mean, I thought we could just sort of wrap up with something else you saw recently.
I really haven't, I really spent like, it feels like I spent a month just sitting home looking at Tribeca films, but, and I think that might be true. The thing that I'm really excited about, I want to see the Boots Riley
Oh, yeah.
Amazon series. That's the only thing I really want to see.
I'm a Virgo.
Yes, I am a Virgo.
Oh,
Yes.
really?
And I can't wait.
That's great. Because, yeah, there's been nothing really since. Sorry to bother you.
I just looked that up when I wrote about it. That was July 2018. It had been in Sundance in 2018. Yes, but I can't wait for this. The trailer looks just fantastic.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that as well. I've been seeing sort of random things like Comrades, Almost a Love Story, late 90s love story, which I liked. And then I just saw the Heroic Trio for fun.
Oh. I love the Heroic Trio.
Yeah, it's so great. It's everything in the kitchen sink and doesn't stop for a breath. And I was like, oh, I wonder what people think of it. I was reading, like, someone said, like, I didn't understand the plot or, like, it didn't make sense. I'm like, that what? Like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's about someone stealing 20 babies who lives in the sewer. Like, of course, it doesn't make any sense. Yeah, that was fun. And I saw it at Metrograph with full audience that was just having a ball with it.
I mean, I'm kind of looking forward to the Barbie movie just because I think she's a really smart woman and a really good director. So I'm just curious what this could be.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I am too. I'm going to see it, and I want to see it on the biggest screen, so it's like the most, you know, it's like that, and you know, I'm going to see Oppenheimer, same deal, biggest screen possible. I love that they're opening on the same
The
day.
same day, the girls' movie and the boys' movie.
So yeah, we'll go back to watching non-Tribeca movies.
Okay, thank you, Nick. This was fun.
Happy viewing.
Oh, same to you.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Special thanks to the Minarets for the opening music. Thank you for listening.